Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Van Maren Show. Today, we're going to be talking to Andrew Lawton. Andrew is familiar to most of you. He is the author of The Freedom Convoy. He is also the author of an upcoming biography on Pierre Poilievre, and he is a journalist with True North here in Canada. I asked Andrew to come on and talk about Bill C-63, which is known as the Online Harms Act. It's this draconian piece of legislation put forward by the Trudeau government. If you've seen commentary on it, you've probably seen Jordan Peterson talking about the impact of this law. He wrote a long essay for the National Post on how he would almost certainly be convicted under that law. It basically seeks to introduce harsher penalties for existing offenses, but would allow sentences of up to 5 years behind bars for what it refers to as hate propaganda. And this is an incredibly dangerous piece of legislation, and Andrew Lawton has been following this issue for years. And so he was kind enough to agree to come on once again and discuss the details of it. Here's that conversation. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us again, Andrew. Really appreciate your time as always. What I wanted to talk about today, which a lot of people are thinking about, is the new hate crime legislation, the new speech legislation coming from the Trudeau government. So you said you looked into this a lot. I guess first, there's been a lot of debate on what this bill actually means and what it contains. Could you enlighten our listeners as to what this bill is actually all about?
Yeah, and part of the confusion has been because it does so much, and it covers under the same piece of legislation a lot of things that I think pretty much any sensible person in the country agrees are online harms, like child sexual exploitation, terrorism content. But it does the same, it takes the same approach to those issues as it does to other things that are far more contentious, like, for example, online hate, which is something that is incredibly contentious because that term means so many different things to different people. And that's why I think the bill, it's actually important to do a deep dive into it here. The stuff that I've been passionate about for many years and the stuff that has riled me up with this piece of legislation is predominantly the online hate section. So in this context, what it does is it reintroduces Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, which was there until 2013 when the previous Conservative government got rid of it, but it changes it, it supercharges it, and it works in a social media element that really wasn't there in the old legislation. And what it does is it effectively gives the Human Rights Tribunal the power to prosecute people for so-called hate speech online, and also forces social media companies to take down this content. And as anyone who's paid any attention to these sorts of issues can tell you, this is just a recipe for disaster when you give government that authority to define and then to execute.
So kind of digging into this a little bit here, what's been interesting in the response to it is of course, like libertarians and free speech advocates such as yourself. Like, again, yeah, the free speech beat has been your beat since as long as I've known you. So predictably, that was going to be one of your concerns. Same thing with Jordan Peterson, who wrote a long essay in the National Post on how he would be absolutely convicted under this law based on things that he has said about, you know, preferred pronouns of trans-identified people and things like that. But, you know, people like Margaret Atwood, the author of A Handmaid's Tale, have also come out and said that this hate speech legislation is Orwellian. And what aspects of it would you say are truly Orwellian? Like, one of the things that stuck out to me is that this bill would actually allow sentences of up to 5 years for so-called hate propaganda, which is up from 2 years. Anybody who knows anything about the Canadian criminal justice system knows that you can murder or rape somebody and get out in less time than that.
Yeah, and I think that's a concerning one. One aspect that has been under the radar in terms of coverage of this that I think is important to point out is the ability to go after people for future crimes, crimes they may commit. This was basically the premise of a dystopian Tom Cruise movie many years ago called Minority Report, but you could actually, under this, if you suspect someone is going to commit a hate propaganda offense or hate crime, you can go before a judge. The attorney general can, an average Canadian can, and someone could be brought into custody for that. So that, I think, is when you really talk about Orwellian, the idea of suspecting and going to a judge and hoping that that process will just be fair. And I think that's the big issue here. One other aspect that I think is important to point out as well is sentencing for hate motivated offenses. Now, just to confirm, this is talking about sentencing. It's not creating a new crime. But if you commit a crime, maybe it's murder, maybe it's sexual assault, maybe it's vandalism, and a judge determines that it was motivated by hatred, you could actually be imprisoned for life. Now, if you read the text of this and just take the bill at face value, this means that if someone spray paints a swastika on a synagogue, which I think is horrible, I think is despicable, and I think should not be done. If someone does that, that is an act of vandalism, which carries a minimal sentence under the human rights or under the criminal code right now. But under this, they could give theoretically a life sentence for that. Now, the only defense I've heard from that is, oh, well, judges aren't going to do that. Well, I don't like legislation where the only guardrail against abuse is just trust us.
Well, that's really interesting because obviously, especially as somebody who is a social conservative watching what's unfolded in Canada since 2015, the obvious question would be, okay, so what is this government's definition of hate to begin with? One of the assurances they've been giving is like, look, only extreme hate speech will be targeted. Well, like, what does that actually mean? Does that mean what they call misgendering? They've referred to, you know, sort of like the million person march for kids and the parental rights rallies as hateful and extremist and far right. If you look at what Trudeau refers to as hateful, it seems really, really unlikely that the sorts of people who are currently advocating for parental rights wouldn't be included in that, especially considering the fact that we recently found out that CSIS actually cites parental rights activists as a potential threat.
Yeah, and let me just, if I can, take on the misgendering aspect, because human rights commissions and human rights tribunals, they exist to, in their view, protect against discrimination through your conduct at a provincial level in employer-employee relationships, landlord-tenant relationships with CHRC, which is the federal one. I get my acronyms all mixed up. They deal with things that are under federal jurisdiction, and internet speech is one of those examples. Now, I'm going to read right now from the Ontario Human Rights Commission website. Now, this is not affected by C63. This is a provincial body, but it shows how the human rights commissions tend to view these issues. The law recognizes that everyone has the right to self-identify their gender and that misgendering is a form of discrimination. So the Ontario Human Rights Commission believes that misgendering is a violation of provincial human rights law. Now, if you extend that to the federal level, misgendering someone on Twitter could literally bring you to before the Human Rights Tribunal, the federal tribunal, and fined up to $70,000.
Wow. And it seems unlikely that this government, at least, wouldn't use it for that purpose. Constantine Crisson, the UK comedian and podcaster, had this bit a couple of years ago where he would ask people, in which country do you think more people were arrested for social media posts, the UK or Russia? And the irony at that time, this is, I think, pre the war in Ukraine, but at that time, more people were arrested in the UK. For social media posts. And I've interviewed people on this podcast that have had the cops show up at their house for posting, you know, poems making fun of trans identified men or saying gender critical feminist things. There was a woman who had a baby who was kept in handcuffs because she had disagreed with a trans activist online. There was a veteran who was arrested for critiquing the LGBT movement on Facebook. So we actually do see that when you have the kind of hate speech laws in place, like that being proposed by Trudeau, that it is almost always used to enforce whatever the state's ideology is and whatever the state's definition of hatred is. And if you look at what's going on in the UK, another example in Scotland was there was actually a construction worker who'd had a bunch of beers who made fun of a guy wearing a dress who identified as a woman. And he actually got a couple of $1,000 and chewed out by a judge for making fun of somebody. That's rude, but not criminal, unless, of course, you define that as hatred specifically. So what do you think this is going to be used for? And do you think that this law has been drafted as broadly as it is in order to be used in this way?
I think they've drafted it broadly because they genuinely don't care about the free speech concerns. I mean, the justice minister who put this bill forward was asked about this, and his only justification for how is this going to protect free speech was, oh, well, the law requires that we respect the charter. Like, well, yeah, but that doesn't mean you're going to do it. It just means you're supposed to do it. Let me just point out, to go back to the sentencing criterion that I described earlier as an offense motivated by hate. That means that someone who burns down a church, which has been happening with increasing frequency in Canada in the last couple of years, if it was determined that was motivated by hate, they would also be eligible for that. But I actually have a very hard time believing that someone who burns down a church would be treated the same way as someone who burned down a mosque or a synagogue, or that someone who spray painted a church would be treated the same way as someone who spray painted a mosque or a synagogue. Now, I believe all are wrong, all are terrible. And the reason I say it would be different is because we see from the political class how these are treated differently. When a mosque in particular is subject to vandalism, Justin Trudeau will get on the first plane and he'll show up and do a press conference there. It took him months and months and months to even acknowledge church burnings, and it was a tepid acknowledgement at best. So if the political class views this one way, it stands to reason the judicial class, which is appointed by that political class, may as well. So already there is a sense that this is not going to be protecting all groups equally. And then when you bring that into the speech realm, absolutely. I don't think that your right to make gender critical comments as a feminist, say, is going to be upheld as much as your right to make trans friendly comments if you're a trans activist. And I think right here we have the case of these administrative bodies, these tribunals that have to pick and choose the winners of whose free speech matters more than the other.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, because it's interesting that you make the comparison between mosques and churches, because a week after the number of church burnings hit, I think 92, the Trudeau government established a formal commission on Islamophobia.
Yeah, I remember that. And there was also that case a couple of years ago where a young hijab wearing girl in Toronto had said that she was assaulted or hijab was removed.
Oh, yeah.
And instantly you had the descent of the political establishment to this girl's defense. And again, the allegation was terrible, but there was no interest in scrutinizing it. And it ended up where police confirmed it just never happened. Now, was this just a girl telling tales? Was this a case of her being put up to it by family? Who knows? But you had right there an example of how uneven the response and the outrage are. Now, I'm a lot more forgiving of media bias than I am of judicial bias, which is what this legislation is going to enshrine.
Do you think that this bill is being drafted the way that it is and pushed as hard as it is because Trudeau realizes that he's probably going to lose the next election pretty badly, and he just wants to implement as many poison pills and sweeping changes as he can prior to that?
So it's a weird one for me, because you may recall the first draft of this bill was tabled just before the 2021 election. It was actually tabled on the last day of the parliamentary sitting before Justin Trudeau dissolved parliament and called the election. And he called the election, so he knew that it wasn't going to pass. He knew that he was putting a bill forward that was never going to see the light of day because parliament would be dissolved in a few hours. So that means that he believes in it and also believes it's a political win, because, again, he was the one that willed that into existence in 2021 before he went to the polls, and he ended up winning that election. So I think that Justin Trudeau certainly believes in it. He believes that online free speech is a scourge. He believes that people should not be able to openly and freely debate things. But he also thinks it's a political win. And that's an issue I've been a little bit unsettled by, because I think he may be right. It used to be, if you and I were to have this conversation 15 years ago, that the Margaret Atwoods would be lining up to condemn this bill, that all of the literary class, the artistic class would be against it. You'd have principled liberals standing up against it. And you can just look at when the Human Rights Commission battles of the mid-2000s with Ezra Levant and Mark Stein and the late Kathy Schadl, when they came up, there were defenders of free speech, and they weren't saying that free speech is this far right idea. They were saying, yeah, you know, I don't agree with what they say, but they have a right to say it. That's gone now. That cultural basis of support for free speech, the first principle that free speech is an inherent good, no longer exists. So I actually think Justin Trudeau thinks this is in fact a political win, and I fear that he's right.
So this is really interesting, and I'd love to pick your brain on this, because one of the assertions I've been making for years, based on all of the many conversations, I've had thousands of face-to-face conversations with Canadians about the most contentious issues, because I'm communications director for a pro-life organization. And one of the things I've often said is that I believe that there is a huge amount of public support for common sense social conservative policies. But that there's just the political circumstances are such that nobody's willing to defend them. And so Canada was considered internationally as like the most pro-LGBT nation. There was no aspect of the LGBT agenda that Canadians wouldn't immediately get on board with. That never made any sense to me, because through immigration, we've been importing, almost 1 million people a year that are, you know, dispositionally disinclined to support that sort of thing. Polling data indicated that most immigrants to Canada weren't even on board with same-sex marriage, much less the newest iterations of this, and that the progressive establishment in this country just sort of asserted that we were this country that believed in all these things. And then, you know, in New Brunswick, Blaine Higgs breaks the logjam, puts forward some like really bare minimum parental rights policies. Like, there really are not, very robust policies in any way, but there's immediate garment rending amongst the progressives about how this is something Canadians oppose. But it turns out a supermajority of people in New Brunswick supported it. And so this was repeated in Saskatchewan by Scott Moe, a supermajority of it supported there. Danielle Smith went farther than anybody else in Alberta by actually restricting puberty blockers for minors. And she also has got both internal polling, and we've seen external polling that shows a supermajority of Canadians support what she's doing. And so I wonder sometimes, is in your view Canada an incredibly progressive left-wing country, or is it just that we entirely lack champions? Like, Trudeau may believe this is a political winner. What would happen though if a popular politician like Pierre started to campaign specifically on this issue?
So Pierre Poilievre has, to his credit, started doing that. He had a press conference a few weeks ago, and I had actually asked him about this because we had heard whispers that this bill was imminent at the time and hadn't yet been tabled. And he was very clear on it. He said, Justin Trudeau, what does he mean by hate speech? And he went through a list of things that Justin Trudeau has said are hate, just to muddle and show exactly how dangerous it is for government to be able to appoint itself the arbiter of so-called hate. I think the problem comes down to the fact that a lot of Canadians haven't thought critically of the edge cases of things that they care about. And it's easy if you poll people and say, do you believe in free speech? You're going to find the majority say, oh, yeah, absolutely. Free speech is a good thing. If you ask the same question sort of if you ask in the inverse, do you think that government has a right to regulate hate speech? People are going to generally agree But the issue comes down to how you define hate speech and what that actually means. And one of the challenges, and I've got a tremendous amount of support for the Jewish community, especially with what they've been facing since October 7th. But the problem with a lot of the Jewish advocacy organizations, in my view, is that they are singularly focused on eroding and ending anti-Semitism, which I completely understand. But they have gotten behind these legislative efforts to restrict speech because it serves that end. Not, I think, realizing, first off, you don't have a right to go after people's free speech just because your group is being targeted by people's free speech. And the other aspect of that that I think is dangerous is that they don't seem to see how that's probably going to be used against them. It's much more likely for the hate speech hammer to come down on someone who is expressing a strongly Zionist sentiment than someone who is expressing a strongly anti-Semitic sentiment, I believe.
Yeah. So, like, maybe game theory this out for us. I've got like 15 thoughts going on at the same time because the details
that
of this
on this issue for me too. It's I understand it.
There's so many different threads to pull on. Let's settle for this. Let's game theory this out a second. How do you think? How do you think that the situation unfolds from here? Do you think this is going to pass and become law and we have to rely on Pierre, a hopefully future Prime Minister Pierre, to get rid of it? Do you think that the backlash coming from even, liberals with staunch credentials like Margaret Atwood coming out against it might give Trudeau pause based on his level of hubris? I find that unlikely, but maybe, who knows? How do you think the situation unfolds from here?
So what I think there are a couple of things to keep in mind. I have no doubt this is going to pass at some point. The Liberals have enough runway to get it done. But there is a big question about what happens to it in the committee process, because parliamentary committees actually have, especially in a minority government, a pretty significant role. And we've seen a lot of very tense fights on big pieces of legislation like medical assistance in dying, for example, that have come down to debates and discussions in committee. So what I would love to see happen here is parties agree to separate out the bill, to say, let's just do two bills. Let's do your child sexual exploitation bill, and let's do your bill that does hate speech, and pull that out, because the Liberals don't actually want to deal with that issue separately. They want to conceal all of these efforts to control online discourse under the guise of child protection, which, as I said at the outset of our discussion, Jonathan, is unlikely to be even controversial among conservatives, liberals, maybe some New Democrats, but for different reasons. And then you look at the hate stuff, like that's where the issues are. But even if they did that, I'm not convinced there's going to be any opposition from the Bloc or the NDP on this, which means it's likely to pass anyway. So the best that the Conservatives could hope for is some level of dilution in the committee stage, but it won't be what it needs to be, which is just killing the bill outright.
And so let's say this thing does pass, maybe with a few amendments. What do you think will be the short-term effect of a piece of legislation like this? Because I know, because I've written about them and I've reported on them, and I know that over at True North, you guys have done the same. There are a lot of activists, trans activists, et cetera, who are eager to use a piece of legislation like this to silence their critics. You've got people like Morgane Ogre and folks like that who are already saying people should not have the right to say X. So they're already asserting this. If the legislation begins to reflect their view, do you think in the short term we would already see the critics of various ideologies supported by the government targeted?
So I'll take it a step back first, if I can, because I think that the short term effects, the one good thing is that government doesn't do anything quickly. And even when this bill passes, it's still going to be incumbent on this. There's going to be a lot of regulatory stuff that needs to happen, where the Canadian Radio Telecommunications Commission needs to come up with its approach on internet stuff. With C11, we still don't have it, even though the bill is passed because of the CRTC. The Canadian Human Rights Commission is going to have to come up with its regulations and processes, and social media companies. Remember, they've got to actually have a response to this as well, because the bill forces them to take down content. So I think that it may take time, which would be in the Conservatives' best interest if there's going to be an election in spring or fall of 2025, which is what we assume, that it might not fully be implemented by then. So it'd be easier to unravel or dismantle. But I also think there's another aspect of this, which is that it sends a chill. All of a sudden, people are very leery of what they can say. And you'll have some rabble rousers like me and perhaps you and a lot of those listening that are unfazed by this, that want to do the old Kathy Schadl thing of telling the Human Rights Commission, you know, come at me. But there are going to be a lot of other people that just don't want to deal with this. And I think that the social media company's response will be quite fascinating, because Facebook, when it was, you know, when the government tried to force it into a certain course of action on paying news companies, Facebook just said, all right, we're just going to block news in Canada, because they didn't want to deal with these pesky regulations from the Canadian government. It'll be interesting to see what they do on this file.
No, that is really interesting. I hadn't considered the implications of what social media might do. Like, I know Elon Musk has spoken out against the bill, but Elon Musk is a very, very libertarian guy, and so that wasn't particularly surprising. Do you think that there is anything that would make Justin Trudeau reconsider this bill? Because one of the things that I find fascinating about the extent to which his skull is airtight is that it doesn't seem to matter who comes against his piece of legislation. He's always sort of like stunned and whinnying with outrage that anybody could question his motives. And a Margaret Atwood's critique probably wouldn't faze him based on his track record. Like, the radical nature of so much of the legislation that he's pushed in the last couple of years and the level of hubris with which he's approached anybody who criticizes it makes me think that there is just nobody this guy listens to anymore. Is that too pessimistic, or is that your view as well?
No, I think you're right. I mean, in one sense, you know, I always believe, just being cynical about these things, that they're going to be responsive to polling, that politicians will actually, when push comes to shove, if they're pushing an unpopular policy, just for self-preservation reasons alone, pull back on it. But I'm softening on that stance given what's happened with the carbon tax right now, which is hardly the most culture war of an issue. But you have a tax that now 7 of 10 provincial premiers are against the government on, including Liberal premiers. You've also got, from that point, a number of Canadians that are against what the government's doing on this, but they're doubling down. And I think that the Liberals are a lot more ideological than poll-driven, perhaps compared to what some people give them credit for. And I think when it comes to controlling internet speech, that's not a political play. I think I said earlier it may be to their political advantage, and I believe that, but I think they just genuinely stand behind what they're trying to do here.
If you could tell every Canadian one basic fact about this piece of legislation that's being obscured in the debate, what would you pick?
What I would say is that it is, I'll read a section, and I think this will basically make the point here. Hate speech is speech likely to foment detestation or vilification of an individual or group of individuals on the basis of a prohibited ground of discrimination. Likely to foment detestation or vilification. And when you read another section and it explains what that means for clarity, it can express detest, or it can't express detestation or vilification, but it's okay if it only expresses disdain or dislike, or it discredits, humiliates, hurts, or offends. So what I would tell Canadians is that if you think that your speech at some point will not be targeted by this, you listen to that definition and tell me where the line is between disdain and detestation, or the line between dislike or vilification, and ask whether you trust the government to draw that line fairly.
What is detestation? I wasn't aware that was a legal term.
Well, they've taken a definition from the Supreme Court, from a Supreme Court decision years ago called the Watcott decision, which was about Bill Watcott, who's an activist in, I believe, Saskatchewan against homosexuality. And his protests have always been rooted in his faith as a Christian. But the thing that's interesting about that decision is there's a section of that Supreme Court ruling, which the government has used as the basis for how it defines hate speech, in which the Supreme Court says something can be true and also be hate speech. So that to me is incredibly dangerous, that we have a definition in legislation now that's enshrined in this idea where even truth in theory is not a defense, that you could be prosecuted for saying something that's true if there's a case made that that is also hateful.
Hmm. One final question. You were very involved in covering the battle over Section 13 back in the day with your friend Mark Stein, with Ezra Levant and a couple of other people. Is this particular battle? I know Ezra's been talking a lot about it. I don't know if Stein has. I haven't read him recently, if he's been talking about this as well. Do you think this is basically where the liberals kind of come screaming back and this time we lose this fight? Or just like the war on Section 13 was won, do you think this is winnable?
I think it's winnable, but I mean, the problem with Section 13 is that people needed to see it in action before there was any political momentum to get rid of it. And I think that right now we have the benefit of a lot more discussion around this issue. We can point to what's happening in the UK. We can even point to Ireland and its atrocious hate speech law. We can do all of these things. And my hope is that we don't need to go down that road of having people censored and prosecuted and targeted to be able to tell people why it's a bad idea. I'm hoping we can do that on spec before it becomes law.
As always, where can listeners find your work?
My show is every day at True North, which is TNC.news. And I have a book coming out in May, which is a biography of conservative leader Pierre Poilievre.
Well, we'll have you on to talk about it again in May then. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was my conversation with Andrew Lawton of True North, an author of The Freedom Convoy, as well as an upcoming biography of Pierre Poilievre. Thank you so much for joining us this week. If you would like to follow the podcast, get it sent to you, please go to lightsidenews.com, click on the podcast tab. You can find us there. You can also download this podcast wherever you get your audio content. Thank you so much. Hope to see you again next week.